Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome to Sentimental Garbage, the podcast where we talk about the culture we love that society sometimes makes us feel bad about. My name is Caroline O'Donoghue and this podcast is hashtag spawn, hashtag gifted and I'm hashtag blessed to have it. Joining me is your Motivation Monday and your Woman Crush Wednesday, Louise O'Neill.
Oh, do you know what's so funny? Because I listen to the podcast every week, so I'm so used to you doing the intro. It's just really funny to watch you do it in real life. Oh my God, it's come to life.
The curtain is down on my podcast influencer live. I'm so excited about today because it's really, you know, generally on this podcast, when people come, or the subjects that I tend to approve are things that I felt really passionately about maybe 10 to 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, yes, yum. I can't wait to talk about the Charlie's Angels movies from the noughties. And it's a fan fest. But the thing with influencer culture is that this is an anti-snobbery podcast. Mm. And there are elements of me that still feel snobby about influence-y-ness things, influencer culture. But the thing about it is that I think influencers have now become so much a part of our lives and part of our digital lives that saying you hate influencers is a bit like saying you hate pop music. It's like, well, you can't hate all of it. Do you know what I mean? There's obviously there's bad stuff and there's good stuff. And I think it's a sort of a, what do you, it's a job description, it's a cultural movement. What's your relationship to it?
You know, I mean, it's funny when you're saying, like, you know, 10 to 15 years ago, because I did a master's in fashion buying in 2009. And I think that was, I mean, it was, you know, now I think it was like around 20 or 30 girls and two gay guys. it was obviously everyone's talking about clothes and everyone's talking about fashion. And I suppose that was the first time that I started to get interested in like what style bloggers at the time.
Right.
So it would have been like Susie Lau and Tavi and Brian Boy and, you know, like people like that and the Sartorialist. So like that, I suppose, was the first time where it was this idea of, I suppose, like, I don't know, that I think that it was being broken down in a way, do you know, and that it wasn't the magazines setting the agenda, or it wasn't necessarily even the fashion industry setting the agenda, that it was people outside of that, normal people, that I suppose the rest of us were kind of looking to for inspiration.
Yeah.
And I suppose that was kind of before, like that was pre Instagram. And I mean, when you talk about influencers on Instagram, like, I mean, I'm obviously, you know, I'm from Ireland, as are you. And I think when, I suppose after Asking for It came out in 2016, I had a lot of people following me who were influencers and I followed them back. Because I don't think it would have been something that might have interested me. Do you know, I don't think I would have gone out of my way to follow these people. So again, I hope that doesn't sound kind of snobby, but it just maybe wasn't really my vibe, if that makes sense.
I think
particularly in, I suppose, sometimes with fashion in particular, or with style, like a lot of the people who seem to be really popular on Instagram, it's a little bit basic. Like, it wouldn't really be something that I would. It's funny. I try and be so kind and compassionate. I really. When we had breakfast together, I think you will vouch
for this.
You're
incredibly kind and compassionate person. No. We're good friends. You are a lovely person.
The comedian Joanne McNally always says to me, she's like, you know, the thing that's getting between us having, you know, like a proper friendship is just you're too nice. I'm not too nice. But then when it comes to fashion, I think it's obviously like the remnants of having worked in fashion, having worked at Elle, I can get like real bitchy. I'm like, well, they're real basic, you know?
But I agree with you. Like, I know nothing about fashion, but like, you know, the odd time I'd be looking at these people who have, you know, 500,000, 1 million followers or whatever, I'm like, okay, you're in high-end exercise gear and you have a blowout. Like, okay. And so we're kind of verging into this sort of snobbery thing again. And like, so similar to you, your sort of first experience of it would have been fashion blogs.
Yes.
And I definitely loved bloggers as well. Hyperbole and a Half was the one that I loved. And like Jenna Marbles, who was...
Yes.
Adored her. Like, yeah. It's so weird that I have watched the entire life cycle of her dog. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Like, I remember when she got Kermit the dog when he was, and he was a young dog, and now he is a very old dog. And that's very rewarding to me. And they sort of influenced my kind of blogging or whatever. But these people, they had fans and they were democratizing a space, but it wasn't a... It wasn't a lifestyle or a job yet in the way that we think of influencers as having a very specific lifestyle. Mm. Where I started getting involved, and I think where my cynicism originated from, was I was working in advertising years ago, and I was on the social media team, and we were like, it was a big agency, and one of the things that the agency was proud of is that it was one of the first agencies in London have like a dedicated social media team. It was quite a big team. It was 20 people. It was all women. Like women were totally controlling that space. Women still control this space, which is something I find kind of cool and inspiring. And within that team, one day when I was about 2 years into the job and when I was really bottoming out, when I was like, I thought I came to London to be a writer.
Yeah.
I've ended up with this job writing for social media brands, like writing for like Wall's Ice Cream on Twitter. And I thought I could be happy with that, but it turns out, and people will often find this in their early 20s, where they have a dream job and they find an approximation of that job that sort of, that pays okay and is sort of... adjacent to the thing they want to do, that they think it will make them happy, but actually it mostly makes you more miserable. You would actually be better off, you know, working in retail or something and then actually pursuing your passions with your whole mind and heart in the evening, in my opinion.
Yeah. I think Julia Cameron calls that shadow artists.
Shadow artistry, yes.
You know,
yes.
The people who, you know, want to be, and then they kind of find jobs, as you said, that are sort of adjacent to it, whether that's maybe being an agent or, you know, like, which I mean, not saying that all agents are frustrated writers or frustrated actors or whatever, but or copywriting or and it's that sense of you're
I'm using the muscle that I want to use, but maybe not in the right way. And I think for me, for the first couple of years, it worked. And then after a while, I just got really resentful and had no energy in the evening to pursue the writing that I actually wanted to write and all that. But anyway, I bring this up because during that very cynical, quite sad time where I was disillusioned with it, we started an influencer team within our social media team. Okay. It was the era of Zoella. It was like we would go into every client pitch with a huge slide of Zoella and be like, and we would be like, let me explain who Zoella is, would be that thing. And we were young women, and we were there to sell to clients the value of this new culture, which was influencer culture. And what that...
You did a great job.
We did a great job. And I was responsible. No. And there was, you know, there was millions of other identical meetings happening all over the world. And that's the thing with influencers, is that influencers need brands to survive. And now brands also need influencers to survive.
Yeah.
Because we had gone through the gamut of brands tweeting as themselves, trying to be likable.
Yeah.
Uncanny Valley, disgusting and weird. Mm. Targeted advertising on social media, fine, and it gets the product in your head, but doesn't make you trust the thing, right? Yeah. So influencers, celebrities, obviously way too fucking expensive. But influencers created this wonderful, this wonderful tool for advertising,
and
right?
And I think that makes sense because, you know, like if I, as you said, if I open up a magazine and I'm trying to think of someone like, you know, I don't know, Gwyneth Paltrow, let's say back in the day, is advertising, she's the face of Revlon lipstick, and I'm like, okay, well, that looks amazing on Gwyneth Paltrow. But if my best friend or if my mother says, you know what, I've used this cleanser or I've used this lipstick or I've bought this book and I really loved it, like that, I'm like, oh, well, I really value that, you know, like I will take that seriously and I will go buy that. And I suppose that was what influencers were an extension of, like people who seemed, you know, who were like just like us. And I suppose at the beginning were, I think, even more honest than maybe they are now, because there wasn't the same, I suppose, expectation from that relationship that they had with brands. So they could really be like, this is great, this is not great. And the people that were following them, I think, just really trusted their opinion.
Yeah. And that is kind of the nucleus of all influencer things, is trust, right? Yeah. And when you get the word like trust, when that's at the center of it, then the kind of the spider diagram of words around that is authentic, real, you know, genuine is a word that comes up a lot. I asked my Instagram. See, this is the thing. This is actually the interesting thing.
Made me laugh. I'm sorry. It was just so like, I put a poll out for my Instagram.
Hi, followers. But I do want to get to that as well, because there's no really way of having this conversation as two people who have like circa 30,000 followers on Instagram without being a little meta. Do you know what I mean?
I know. I mean, I think for me, like, I definitely think people trust if I post about a book in particular.
Yeah.
Like, I'll really see that where if I'm like, I really loved this book.
Yeah.
That there will be a lot of people in my DMs going, I'm going to buy that book. You know, I've just downloaded that onto my Kindle or, you know, whatever. And I would love it if more brands wanted to send me things. I keep going, you know, when you see...
Brands like, definitely do send you things.
Oh, honestly, not that much. I'm obviously not on any PR list. And it's funny because, like, you know, my partner is a journalist in Ireland, and he has like, I don't know, like 145,000, you know, followers, and obviously cannot accept... and would not accept anything, and I'm very resentful of it. I'm like, Richard, we could be getting a free door for our house. We could be getting a free holiday. He's like, Louise, I'm a journalist, and I journalistic ethics. But from my perspective, I suppose it's that sense of, and it's funny, whenever now I post about something that I do like, I'll often see myself adding, this is not an ad. I paid for this. And like, there's something so funny about it. And then I saw someone who I noticed, like, just a friend, you know, who had, I'd say, around 300, genuinely 300 followers posting about I can't even remember now, something that she was really enjoying. And she said, this isn't an ad, I just really liked it. And I felt like going, I wouldn't have thought it was an ad.
It's like, babe, you have 612 followers.
No, it was 300. It was less, you know. It's like, no, you're fine. So how do you...
That's quite sweet.
I know. And how do you navigate that?
Okay, so this is a weird conversation to have with the listeners. Yeah. But I'm interested in it, and I hope they will be too, because sort of prior to Sentimental in the City, I had like 6,000 followers on Instagram and maybe 16,000 on Twitter. But that was like a cumulative thing. I'd been a journalist for a long time. I'm definitely a person that's like, I've never been like a personal life person, but it's like, here's my little joke, off into the ether you go kind of thing, or here's my opinion or something. And I had been peeling off Twitter, and Twitter sort of, when you don't use it for a while, you don't. It doesn't really. When you tweet, it doesn't really get the same kind of numbers or whatever. That's the sort of game of Twitter. Or maybe people just lost fucking interest. I was tweeting less, but anyway, then Sentimental in the City happened, and obviously lots of people listened to that. Like, it's changed. It changed a lot of things about my life in a really fucking positive way. Like, for the first time, like, people coming up to me on the street.
Yeah, it was just so wonderful. I felt like I kept sending Caroline like these really long voice messages, like just being like, I just listened and I feel this. And I think you were like, oh my God, please stop it. I can't have this with every episode.
No, it was lovely. It was gorgeous. And like a huge mass of new people following me. People coming up to me in the streets, like, really lovely, and you know, and like, also just to be cynical, money. Do you know what I mean? This podcast never made money before that. Yeah. Now it makes like a significant amount of money. It'll probably be the difference between me buying a house in 2 years versus me buying a house in five. You know. Yeah.
Can I just say though, that's not cynical. And actually, I think we should circle back to money and that kind of, you know, how that plays out in the influencer sphere. Because, like, we all need to pay our bills. We all need to pay our rent. We all need to pay our mortgage. Like, it's okay to want to make money out of, like, your work, you know?
Yeah. And this, you know, this podcast is a lot of work. Like, booking guests, doing research, blah, 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 blah. It's a lot of time. I'm fine to be making money for it. But there was this difference in... first of all, how many people were talking to me, and also how they were talking to me, and I could feel myself getting a little sick. And it's not because of anything any one person said, but it's more the cumulative sense of attention. There was this sense of like people complimenting me for things that I hadn't worked for, which felt weird. Like, I love your friendship is a weird, like, it's nice, yeah. but it's a weird compliment.
Yeah.
And like asking me where I got things that like feel like very basic, like a white vest that I'm wearing. It's like, it's a vest. Yeah. I'm sorry. It's very hard to talk about this without feeling awkward. And then there was also this thing of like, people had gotten really invested in this friendship that I had with Dolly, and they, like, it's that meme of podcasting, right? Where, you know, the someone next to a picture of two people on the radio, like, and them talking along kind of thing. It's like people thinking they're in the conversation.
Yeah.
And then talking to me in the same way that I would talk to Dolly, which would be sort of like cheeky, irreverent, fun, intimate. And then they're bringing that to me and it feels quite weird.
Yes. But I suppose that's like, you know, the parasocial relationship, which is at the heart of influencer culture, is that because these people seem like just like you or me, you know, that yeah. there's not that remove that there would have been with incredibly famous or incredibly, you know, beautiful or incredibly sort of gifted. Like, not saying that you're not any of those things, you know. But like, you know,
excuse
what I'm saying?
Excuse me, I'm beautiful, I get it.
Well, you are, of course, but you know what I'm talking, like, you know, like Angelina Jolie, you're not like, yeah. she's not like the girl next door, you know?
Yeah.
And I suppose, yeah, it's that sense of that, and I think with influencers, like, again, you know, I suppose that they've been able to monetize their ability to be open and be charming and sort of, you know, be authentic. Even though I think that the mere action of sort of holding a phone up to your face for all of us yeah. and speaking into the phone means that you're performing. Like, whatever yeah. you're, if you're sad or if you're happy or whatever you're doing, like, you're performing that. And I think there's a performance of authenticity as well. But I suppose, like, in order to do that, in order to make money from this job, you have to let people in. Like, you yeah. kind of have to let them into your home, you have to let them into your family, you have to let them into your wardrobe, you know, like, whatever, I suppose, the sphere in which you're kind of influencing in. And I think often that parasocial relationship can feel as if they, number one, know you, but number two is if you owe them something, or that yeah. they're that and I'm not talking from personal experience, but I'm talking, you know, from
you sort of are.
Well, but it's not to the same extent. Like, you know, I don't think anyone really feels entitled to know what my house looks like, or like yeah. you know, like, what I had for breakfast, or how much I spent on a pair of shoes, or, you know, whatever. Whereas I think if that's your job, mm-hmm. like, I do think that, like, and I think that's really tough, because you have to make your life becomes content. And we all have a little bit of that, I think, you know, when you go somewhere beautiful and you're like, oh, I'd love to take a photo of this for Instagram, mm-hmm. or, you know, whatever. But I think if that's your job, it becomes very difficult to continually mine your own life for content. But also, I think having to deal with people that, as I said, feel entitled to, like, a part of you or a part of your privacy. And, like, how do you set up, like, how do you have any kind of boundaries when these people are essentially kind of paying your wages?
Yeah.
Do you know? And, like, it's funny, because, like, I grew up in a really small town, as you know, and, like, my parents owned a butcher shop. And I remember this woman once saying to me, she was like, you know, I'll be paying for your college fees. And I was really taken aback by that.
Wow.
You know,
like, this customer, just someone in the town.
Yeah.
Right,
just someone
right.
who was, like, a good customer. And I think when you're brought up with that attitude of, like, the customer's always right and you have to be very polite and you're like the customer. Yeah. And, like, and there was a real appreciation of, yes, these customers are paying for my shoes.
And they're also
paying.
Our neighbours.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
But they were literally, like, when they bought stuff in the shop, they were paying for my shoes, they were paying for my school books, you know.
Wow.
But I think to be reminded of that in a way felt so confronting. And I think when I look at influencers, that kind of is what is at the back of my
mind.
Oh, that's
so interesting. God.
Yeah. So it's just hard, I think. Like, how do you have to be polite.
Yeah.
Like, even if someone is saying something, you're like, okay, great. Because I think it's like you're making money off that engagement. So
yeah.
how do you set up those boundaries of, this is making me uncomfortable, you're invading my privacy here, you know?
So this is it. So to go back to the sort of the sudden influx of followers kind of thing, I think being sort of 31, 32, and having lots of people that I know really well, like you, like Dolly, like my friend Ella, who had been through it already, mm. and I'd watched how it can make you a bit ill,
yeah.
kind of thing.
Yeah.
So, like, if you don't mind me talking about this
a little bit.
So a few years ago, you brought out a book called Asking for It, mm-hmm. and it was about a rape in a small town.
Mm-hmm.
And it performed extremely well. People really loved it. And it was also one of these things where it's like a conversation that was happening And now there was a piece of art that represented it in a really complicated and wonderful way, and a way that like really like changed things and helped create this sort of tipping point into like, we are all talking about this. Mm. And because it's something that you feel very passionately about, because you're a very, you know, you're a brilliant, passionate speaker, because you're a young woman, because you're a person who, like, if you don't mind me saying, looks great and wears cool clothes. You became somebody who was willing to talk a lot to a lot of people about your beliefs on Twitter and to the press. And this made you like very famous. And then people were really awful to you.
Yeah.
Not everyone, obviously, but there was a contingent of people who were fucking awful to you.
Yeah.
And then you became another representation of the phrase asking for it.
Yeah.
Which was very fucking ironic.
Do you know, my dad was the first person in my family to read Asking for It. And I was a little bit worried because, you know, he was a sort of a football star and like, you know, I had grown up in this small town. And I thought, God, this book is sort of a damning indictment of a lot of those things. And I remember he came to me after he'd read it and I said, oh, you know, what did you think? And he said, Louise, it's so powerful. And I said, I'm delighted. And he said, but I hope you're ready. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, well, there's going to be a lot of people who read this book and some of them will realise they've been raped and other people will realise that they've raped someone. And those people will not want to have had that realisation and you will be the messenger. And I was really like going, okay, but you know, I don't think you can kind of take that on board. And then when I suppose, as you said, it just came at the right time and it was just before Me Too. And I think, you know, people were ready to have this conversation. And I think Asking for It like felt like kind of a good vehicle to do that. And then it started a little bit online. And then I would get a lot of messages from people saying, I don't know if you see what people are saying about you on Reddit, or I don't know if you've seen what people are saying about you on this particular board. I think there was like three of them. They were like, I think you should get legal representation. Like, this is bad. Right. And I never looked, ever, because I felt like if I saw it, I would never be able to unsee it.
Mm.
But when my partner and I first started dating, I think one of his friends sent him something. I think it was a line like, maybe I shouldn't say it, but anyway, it was just something really just so vile. And I was really shaken by what, you know, just sort of the implications about my partner and about me. And he didn't really care, but I thought, you know, if this had been someone, I mean, he works, you know, as I said, he's a journalist, so he works in the media. But I thought, God, if this had been someone who wasn't working in the media, they could have been really frightened off by this, you know. And a lot of the time it made me feel incredibly unsafe. And like I've been living in Dublin and I moved back home and I think like even with my friends, like I just kept everything so much smaller. Like I just really
and
started
you, and
to
you closed up shop
that.
Online. Yeah. Like you deleted Twitter, Facebook gone.
Yeah.
You were like an email only person.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Facebook, I mean, like I'm not 60. So like,
I mean, but it was Facebook 6 years ago when there was still something.
I know.
It was a heartbeat at least.
And like my, you know, Richard like does my Twitter now. And I think, I suppose it's because he's like, you know, there's, I don't know, 34,000 or whatever thousand followers. Like it's small, but like he was like, you know, it's still people, you know, that you'll let them know the new book is coming out and you know all of these things. I'm on Instagram, but I think I never found Instagram quite as compelling. But actually, I suppose I in analysing my own relationship with social media, I think I found it like I realised how addictive it is, and that even when it was bad. Like it's funny. I mean, I've had an eating disorder, and in a lot of ways, it sort of aligned very closely with that experience of this is bad for me, and I hate it, but I can't stop.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that was like, you know, that kind of experience of social media felt very similar to that. And when I sort of took a break from it, I had these terrible cravings to go back on and, you know, to be on my phone, which, you know, subsided, but it took a bit of time. And then I thought, and then I think it just opened up. You know, I went to Thailand with my mother. My uncle lives there, so we were going to visit him. And we just had this amazing time. And I felt like I don't need to take any photos. I can just be present. And I think I kept thinking about influencers. Like, I just was thinking, God, imagine not being able to go away for a weekend and just put your phone in a drawer and just be able to be present and really just like enjoy it. Like the pressure of constantly thinking, well, what's the best photo and where's the best angle to take this and what will get the most engagement? And
this is the
thing. I think it's exhausting.
I think the biggest mistake people make about influencer culture is that it's money for nothing.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you've, you know, first of all, living in London, you see influencer shit just happening on the daily. Mm-hmm. Like you're walking down the street and you see someone taking a million photographs at like a cute doorway kind of thing. You know, right? And that's like the lowest tier. And like they're getting their boyfriend to take the picture again and again and again and again. And like there's something kind of sweet about that almost. But then like you go a next tier up. Like I've been on like press trips for things where I was writing about the holiday and I've been, the other person on the press trip will be an influencer. And the amount of work they're putting into every single part of that day to make sure that every part of the day, like I'm taking notes and being like, okay, I'm at this village and we're doing this and I'm writing it down on my phone. But then I'm just kind of fucking sitting back and waiting to see what happens. To make sure that every single part of that day has a moment that can then be distributed later is a huge amount of work. Like the their luggage, like the fact that they have to make 4 days look like 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And they take so like so many outfit changes and that kind of stuff. Like I was recently at this event. I was like hired to be there. It was like a big launch where they had like other authors there as well. And I saw this girl and she was probably the most beautiful girl I've ever seen in real life. And she was in this like rented dress. And it was kind of like a cosplay element to this dress, like a princess dress. And there was, I watched her person, either her boyfriend or her representative or her assistant or whatever, take these TikToks of her spinning around and around in circles. And I watched her go around and around and stop for a break and around and around and stop and around and around. And I was like, how can you see?
Yeah.
You can like it's such like the idea that this is a job that is easy is ridiculous to me. It's like incredibly tedious, actually.
Yes. And I think, look, you and I are both writers. And I think often, you know, particularly at the beginning of your career, you know, you're asked, and I think anyone who works in a creative field will recognize this, like, that you're asked to work for no money, or you're asked to, you know, it's for exposure, or you know, or you're there's no budget for a fee anyway. And I think it's sort of linked to this idea that if you have a job that seems easy, or if you have a job that, like, I suppose that you're doing something that you're naturally good at, or you're, you know, that, or you're doing something that you enjoy, or that other people would like to do this job as well. There is a sense of, oh, you shouldn't be paid for that. And I do think when it comes to money, I do think that, and I suppose all of the freebies and I suppose the lifestyle that comes along with being an influencer, I do think there's kind of a resentment and almost a, well, why am't I, you know, or why aren't I, that's very Irish, why am't I, why aren't I getting, you know, why aren't I getting this bag, or why aren't I getting, you know, this makeup? And I think it breeds this resentment. But the thing is that the reason why I suppose that there are certain people who have built this huge audience is because they're good at it. And you know, you really see that with people. Like, I know even at home, there's this influencer called James Kavanagh. And he's just really good at what he does. Like, he's really funny. And he puts, you know, like, he's very, I think he worked in marketing before. So, you know, his ad campaigns are just very, very funny. And it's like, not everybody can do that. Or not everybody, I suppose, even is very beautiful and very tall and wears clothes really well. Or I think it's just this anger that sort of surrounds it, and you know, particularly with something like, you know, Tattle Life, or and I suppose the thing is that of course there should be space for legitimate criticism. Of course there should be, and you know, particularly if people are not obeying, you know, the advertising laws, and they're not saying,
which
sponsored,
which nominally,
or, you know,
is supposed to be what Tattle Life is supposed to be about, right? About like identifying those who are not having like clear or ethical standards and practices within their sponsorship deals. What it actually is a fucking cesspit of just incredibly mean shit about people who are just trying to.
But isn't it interesting that, you know, I suppose, when you think about influencers, and even when we were talking earlier about the snobbery, and like this whole podcast is about reclaiming things that have been dismissed because they've been seen as sort of traditionally female. And I often think that like jobs where women earn more than men or women are more successful than men. You know, like whether that's modeling or, I mean, so sex work or like, you know, even I suppose I take something like commercial women's fiction. Do you know the way, like, I mean, that sells in some million, you know what I mean? It's just like, it just makes so much money and sells so much that it has just been dismissed as silly and trivial and superficial. And I think because so many of the people in this space who are making the most money and who are the most successful are women, there is that kind of snobbishness, you know, attached to it. And I suppose, but then it is interesting when you think of something like Tattle Life, because most of the people who are on there as well are women too.
It's like, this is the thing, women have created this industry and they've also destroyed the people within it, kind of thing.
Yeah.
Like, and I think what's so interesting, we've talked a lot about the influencers themselves, but we haven't talked about the instinct to follow, watch, and eventually destroy them. As I said earlier, I asked my followers, sort of traditional influencers that they loved and why they loved them. And I got so many responses and a huge like diversity of people, right? And like there was definitely levels within it of like, there was definitely like what I would say is the completely easy mode, not worrying at all, which is people who are, what I find very interesting, in a life stage that you are either preparing for or are new to, like, so people who want to have children or are pregnant and they want to, and they don't have many maybe mothers in their lives, or they want to do motherhood in a different way, and they look at these people and they're like, okay, she's doing something different and new, and it, and like she looks like she really fucking enjoys and loves her kids, and like,
or is struggling, or is like really,
or is open about her struggling.
Exactly.
Or it could be that, like, you know, you want to, you know, you're heading towards buying your first house and you want people who have like taken kind of shitty little houses and made them amazing for very little money. I mean, that's obviously very fucking satisfying.
That's all I follow at the moment. Real like woman in her 30s.
Yeah.
All the interiors.
Oh my God. So great. And it's like, or there's like the experts within specific spaces.
Yes.
And these people are very interesting to me as well, where they might not even have a ton of followers. It could be like 14,000 followers, but they're like, they're gluten-free and they're vegan and they're celiac or something.
Yes, or skincare or, you know, things like that. Like, you know, like if someone has a specific, I suppose, I don't know, like acne or, you know, like anything like
that. Yeah, or if they have acne because of polycystic ovaries and they're dealing specifically with that.
Yes, very
niche,
yeah.
Yeah, and it's, and that to me feels very like healthy and normal. And also exciting because it's like, or whether it's like body positivity and all that kind of stuff, where it's like, oh, our definitions of celebrity and of expert and of trusted individual was prior to this extremely narrow, you know, like magazines that are owned and run by enormous corporations where, like, you know, we've all seen any rom-com from the 90s. Like, we all know how a magazine works, which is that it's totally beget to like, you know, advertisers and editors who have very traditional standards of beauty, designers who have traditional standards, like,
absolutely.
The fact that, like, I've spoken to so many people who were like, I just radically overhauled what the images I look at every day.
Yes.
And now I don't hate my body.
Yes.
You know?
Yes. I totally agree. And I did an event with Bethany Rutter last night. And, you know, like, following fat women, you know, who just like love their bodies and like wear gorgeous clothes and, you know, like, that I felt was just really, I mean, you know, they talk about fat liberation and obviously, you know, I'm not fat, but like I found it liberating, do you know?
Yeah.
I found it just really joyous, I think, to follow people like that. And I suppose that is what I would say to people as well, is like the whole concept of like a hate follow, I think is a terrible idea. Like follow people that you feel inspired by, or you feel, I don't know, moved by, or you really enjoy, or you think they're really funny, or you love their, you know, whatever. I just think, why invite the negativity into your life of just being like, I fucking hate this bitch.
So I think what happens with the negativity is it's interesting because, like, you, some people just do just fucking, you're having a bitchy brunch with someone and they're like, did you see this fucking dose online? And I'm like, no, show me the dose online. And then I follow the dose. I think that obviously does happen. But I think what's actually more common is you follow someone that you're interested in, maybe early in their journey. The journey is a big word for influencers as well. The journey. And then they kind of get sort of famous in their space and you're sort of pleased for them. And then maybe their content, because they're getting more money from more brands, it becomes more diluted by advertising. You feel like a separation from them or even a betrayal. And then the bigger they get or the more distant that you feel their content has gone from the original content, because Instagram doesn't know that you're going through this emotional journey, you're still following them.
Yeah.
You know, so, and you'll still get shown their thing. And so you're witnessing what you feel is like, oh, this girl I used to go to school with, and now in your mind and heart anyway, and now she's an asshole.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think a lot of people, I think we all have had that experience where you meet someone in real life and you're like, God, you've got a really annoying online persona. But you're so, and I'm always like, I'm probably that person. You know, the way you're so like afraid. But I think there is that, sometimes there can feel like that I suppose that disconnect. But then there are people that I just like, I'm not sure if you follow Candice, is it Brathwaite? I'm not sure.
Oh my God.
I just like, she is just,
she's
like
amazing.
She just brings so much happiness to my life. She does like outfit of the day, and she has the most amazing clothes, and she loves colour, and they're always just like these, you know, like really bright and just beautiful outfits. I think every time I see her, like, oh, there you go.
There's there you are.
Little burst of
good
happiness there in my morning.
Or Taryn Devere as well.
Oh yeah, she's great.
Who's kind of, what's brilliant about her is like, she's one of those people who like I've been following for a long time because she did the odd funny tweet or TikTok or whatever.
Yes.
And then like watching her explode over lockdown because she was dressing like things in her house. Like literally
the
like a brick of butter.
Yeah. The creativity was just incredible. And like, I like to think, you know, it's funny. I remember doing marketing at college as in part of my fashion buying course. The marketing professor said something like, oh, you know, I was talking to a man once and he said, oh, I don't buy into advertising. Mm-hmm. And then he asked him, he said, what kind of car do you have? And he goes, oh, I have a Toyota. They're the best built cars in the world. And it was just so funny.
Oh, wow.
The way even when we think that we're completely immune to it, like that this stuff does creep in. And like, I'm like, oh, I'm not into influencers. But, you know, when we met earlier and you said, I love your eye. I'm wearing like lilac eyeliner, and you said, oh, "I love your eyeliner. Is that Glisten?" And then I said,
"Oh, I've been hovering on buying that Glisten products for a while, and now I see it.
Yes,
and I'm gonna buy it." And then you said,
"Then I said, I was like, well, that's really funny because Louise McSherry, who is an Irish woman and is just really into makeup, she was wearing it, and I bought it because of her." And actually, she's probably a very good example of someone that I really trust. And I think when we come back to the trust element, and when you're talking about, I suppose, someone like really exploding, is that you have to, I think for influencers, like the ones who are really good at it, I think maintain that balance between, you know, here are my kids, here is my breakfast, you know, here's something, and then here's an ad.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, sometimes if you follow someone and it's just like ad after ad after ad, it's like, and particularly if it's four things that feel completely odd and you're like, there's no way that you use that.
Yeah.
Or I find if an influencer is constantly shilling, this is my favorite moisturizer. And then 2 weeks later, this is my favorite moisturizer. And you're like, well, okay, bitch, which one is it? You know? So like, I think,
okay, bitch, which one is it?
But I think there has to be a level of like, I mean, I was going to say cop on, which is so Irish, but you know, that like, that people aren't idiots. And you know, that you, they're like, that of course we respect, you know, that you are, well, I suppose a lot of people respect that, you know, you have to make money and you're doing these ads. But I think like, you know, I think Molly Mae Hague, actually, which would be a good person to talk about as well, you know, from Love Island, was talking about that she had been offered £1 million from a brand. And she was like, but I would never wear those clothes. So she didn't take the deal. And I thought, you know, there's something very canny about that, because you're looking at your brand in a long term sense. And you're like, look, you know, if I want people continuing to come back and trust me, I can't sell them shit. And like, I used to work in retail, and you know, it was fine somewhere like New York because there was such footfall that someone would come in and you're like, well, I'll never see them again, so it doesn't matter. But if you were working in like a boutique in a small town, if you tell someone that something looks nice on them and they go home and show it to their partner or their, you know, their sister or their friend, and they say, that is the worst thing I've ever seen on you in my life. Like, they're not going to trust you and they're not going to come back in. So I think it is about building. Like, I love that I keep bringing it back to like my small town, like life.
But it's a great microcosm of influence, right? Yeah. Because people are influenced by people in small towns. But it's also this reminder that like, the tools are new, but the behavior is not.
Yes, exactly. That we are, like, we're social creatures.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I suppose it's funny because obviously, you know, like my new book, Idol, deals a lot with influencer culture. And like off, you know, like in the interviews, particularly if they're with kind of older men, they're a bit like, God, influencer, terrible, aren't they? And I always say, look, I'm not coming to this from a place of cynicism.
Yeah.
Like, I'm actually looking at this and thinking, like, this seems like a really difficult job. And, you know, we've talked about, I suppose, that sense of never kind of being able to take a break from it. But I think also...
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.
When, you know, when we spoke there about like coming off Twitter, a big part of that was this exhaustion of constantly needing to have an opinion.
Yeah.
You know, like being like something terrible would happen in the world. And instead of feeling like that, I just need to take a minute and do some reading, and I don't really know as much about this maybe as I know about this other subject. But it felt like if I didn't like respond immediately with, you know, like the kind of perfect response to this, that it was almost taken as, well, you don't care. And I've really seen that, like, you know, talking about Molly May, you know, she did that interview where, you know, she was saying basically like we all have the same 24 hours in the day, and people said, yes, but, you know, you're the head of Pretty Little Thing, or you're the creative director of Pretty Little Thing. You can't say that you have the same 24 hours as someone who's basically working in like slave conditions or, you know, whatever, in one of these factories. And I thought that was a really valid conversation, but I also thought, like, Molly May seems like a, I mean, I watched that season of Love Island and she seemed lovely and she seems very canny and very, you know, like a great business brain. But like, not someone that I would be looking to for an incisive commentary on the class structure in Britain. And I think you see that with like influencers who have become like very popular because they have great taste in interiors or they have great personal style.
Yeah, suddenly having to deliver opinion.
It's like, what do you think of the, you know, events, Israel Palace? And I think they're probably like, oh God, you know. And I do think that this sort of, also I think, and I suppose that's a double-edged sword in that, yes, it's great when they can raise awareness because they have so many people listening to them and they have so many eyeballs on them.
Yeah.
But I also think that like, I suppose the idea that whatever they're doing online is the extent of what they're thinking about or what they're, you know, talking about. Like, you have no idea. Maybe they're making donations, you know, you don't know. And I suppose it just feels like the expectations are, maybe I'm being too generous, but like.
But I think it's interesting because like, if we take something like the Fire Festival, right?
Yeah.
Which is like, God. I was so fucking funny, and I watched both documentaries. Mm-hmm. And like, that really showed that there's a real, it's so interesting that people do genuinely love these people, right? Mm. And like, when I did that sort of poll online, there was people who came back to me talking about how deeply they felt about these people that they follow, and they know it's a little weird, but like, there was even one girl who I thought was so sweet. She was like, this is the woman that she follows and has followed for years, and she feels so attached to her that even when she goes on these really long, boring, talking to camera stories, she puts the stories on mute and watches all of them,
God,
just so she won't see that people have dropped off.
That, I mean,
because she was like, the idea of like hurting her feelings is so sad to me.
That is so sweet.
I thought it was so nice. But then on the other side, there's the Fire Festival thing where it's like, oh, let's watch these fuckers burn kind of thing. And it's kind of gorgeous to us.
But I suppose if you're talking about the Fire Festival, like, you know, it just reminded me of Kendall Jenner. And I suppose you really can't talk about influencers without talking about the Kardashians.
Yeah.
You know, and I was chatting to someone about this recently because I have never watched. I mean, and I'm not saying this in a, I'm an intellectual. I mean, I just said I watched Love Island. So like, it's like, I just have never watched an episode of The Kardashians. I don't follow any of them online.
Yeah, yeah, no, nor I.
And again, that's not, you know, it's some of the smartest women I know love The Kardashians, love Housewives. It's not a judgment. But I was talking to someone, I said, okay, so I don't follow them online. I haven't watched anything. And I know everything about these women's lives. And I'm like, how do I know this? Like, their influence, like, you can see it everywhere. You can see it in, like, they have completely changed, I suppose, like, what body shape is popular. They've completely changed, I suppose, the way in which people think about lip fillers or, you know, like, and cosmetic surgery. It's been, like, really fascinating. Like, they have completely changed
just everywhere.
Culture.
Like, even on the way in here this morning, I was sort of researching and looking at my phone about the Kardashians for, like, kind of the first time, because I'm the same. It's just, like, for some reason, that breed of reality show never scooped me up in the same way other things have scooped me up, you know? There's lots of trashy things I like, just that's not one of them. We're, like, apologising for not watching the Kardashians.
It almost sounds like you're trying to say, like, I'm better than...
Yeah, and I don't think I'm better than them.
I don't. And I think the thing is, what I find really fascinating about the Kardashians is that in a way they have profited, like, you know, they have made the patriarchy work for them. Like, I think that they are as much, I suppose, trapped in the system as everyone else, but they have, you know, found a way to monetize it. And I mean, I'm not saying that's a good thing. You know, I'm definitely not an, you know, shilling of
diet tea.
Yes.
Kind of stuff.
And that, I think, is really harmful. But I suppose I also find it, I think it can be kind of low-lying fruit. You know, when people go after the Kardashians, I think it's like, well, they're kind of an easy target.
I judge people more for going after the Kardashians.
Yeah,
really.
I think you have to have a
because,
sense of
just
nuance.
Because it's like a basic take, you know?
Yes, and I think there is that sense of being like, okay, a part of me does not like what the Kardashians are legitimizing, this kind of consumerism, this obsession with wealth, I suppose displaying that wealth with, you know, like, and it feels, I mean, at the, I suppose particularly at this time, not just insensitive, but also like environmentally dangerous, you know?
Yeah.
And so there's a part of that that I find like just a little bit grotesque. But I'm also like, I suppose it's their money, and you know, it's like, and their bodies, and they can, and their social medias, and you know, it's just, I think, trying to have like, I don't think these people are the devil, but also I think that it is important, I suppose, to have a conversation about, like, I suppose, their influence.
It's like,
well,
it's just sort of like proportionate responsibility, yes, right?
Yes, yes, exactly. Like, I'm like, they're not, but I suppose it is that thing where you're like, okay, they're not responsible for everything, but like the influence they have had, like you see this in like particularly like women online, and you know, when I'm like, you know, the Discover page, and sometimes I'll go, wow, like, good, like just the shape of, you know, like these tiny waists, and you know, obviously having had BBLs or, you know, whatever, and these tiny waists, and like, you know, really curving out into like, you know, a big, and it's just like that is amazing. Like, there's only, how many of them is there?
But yeah, six? Even like, this is such a silly thing to say, but like, I feel like for 100 years, the highest beauty standard was very white women with very blonde hair.
Yeah.
And the Kardashians are half Armenian.
Yeah.
And obviously they've had many accusations of like blackfishing and, mm-hmm. and trying mm-hmm. to obscure their ethnicity to sort of appear biracial or whatever.
Which are very legitimate.
Which are very legitimate critiques. Yeah. But it's kind of amazing how, like, very dark hair, very big arses, like, sort of a deeper skin tone has changed the beauty standard. And it's, like, changed it to something even more, not even more, but just as restrictive.
Exactly. And just as impossible.
And just as impossible. But the fact that it's shifted so quickly is fucking fascinating to me. And that it's gone from, like, you know, Claudia Schiffer type, Gwyneth Paltrow's, to people look like the Kardashians, who always would have been beautiful, but now it's like, that's what every young
woman
wants to look like.
Of beauty. Yeah. And like, I remember a friend saying to me years ago about, we were just talking about standards of beauty, and particularly, I suppose, pertaining to weight. Mm-hmm. And she said, you know, what I always try and remember is that like, in the 90s, like really skinny eyebrows were like all the rage. Oh God, I feel like Gen Z are getting into it. I'm like, guys, they won't grow back. Please just leave your eyebrows alone. And then, you know, I think Cara Delevingne came and, you know, like the very full the boy brow, sort of, yeah. And it's just, she's like, I mean, if it's that easy to change, you know, like if it's that, what's the word I'm looking for?
Elastic, I guess.
Yes. You know, it's like, it's just sometimes in a way it's just easier to sort of reject all of it and be like, well, this is my body. And I think when you look at the Kardashians, like they have been such disruptors in this space. But yeah, it's I suppose, you know, sometimes when we're talking about this, it can feel a bit like girl boss feminism or like white feminism, where it's like, oh, well, if women are profiting from capitalism, then therefore that has to feminism. Be a good thing. Yeah, exactly. You know, and it's like, no, capitalism is hurting all of us.
But
and
at the same time, I find it interesting, kind of adjacent to the Fyre Festival thing. I remember during COVID, there was this whole thing about influencers who were going to Dubai to just escape it, essentially. And there was, I think it was this morning, where they had invited this influencer on. I can't remember if she was in the studio or via Zoom or whatever. They invited her on to talk about her trip to Dubai, and they attacked her. It's the thing. Well, yes, of course, it deserves critique. But when I was actually looking at it, and people were going wild online, because it's generally a very anodyne show, to them suddenly be so furious at this young woman who had made this choice. It was like, oh, but this, it feels like kind of a Marie Antoinette situation. Of course, Marie Antoinette was sort of a thoughtless and selfish leader, but this is also becoming a pressure valve for the nation to release its tension on. And because the person is a young woman who, albeit has made a shit choice, it's a safe valve for us to dump our bile.
Exactly. And I think it is interesting.
So we're talking about these women who are often working class, who often like haven't gone to university or have the same standard of education as, say, a journalist or someone on who's working for This Morning, has been sort of roped in to this situation. Like, does that feel like a classist thing to you?
It does. And I think it's so easy to attack that person or to make them look really vapid.
Yeah.
Whereas actually, again, when I keep coming back to this, like, it is a skill set and not everybody can do it. But it was, again, when I talk about low-lying fruit, you know, or low-hanging fruit, sorry, that's the expression. It's like, it's just, I don't know, it just feels really gross the way that they can get attacked in this way. And
because there's the thing about influencers is that they have disrupted a space that was previously guarded by gatekeepers,
exactly.
But and that's exciting because it's like non-normative body standards, like the more diversity of people, whether it's like, you know, disabled people, people who are trans, we're seeing more and more people get famous online and then disrupt old spaces.
Exactly.
And that's fucking exciting.
Yeah.
However, because there are no gatekeepers, it means there are no gates. It means that if you attack some random girl who went to Dubai during quarantine, who gives a fuck? Because it's not like she, you know, is part of a old media machine that will then isolate you. It's not like she works with Anna Wintour and now Anna Wintour won't send over any more celebrities, you know?
Yes, and I think, you know, like even when I was talking about earlier, but let's say Susie Lau or like the Man Repeller, or, you know, like there was, I remember when I was working for a fashion magazine, like there was this conversation of almost like these upstarts, you know, and you know, they were getting front row at the fashion shows. And it's like, well, what about the, you know, the style director or the whatever this magazine? And I you know, I suppose we're coming back to that idea of like the democratization of it. And I think that is exciting. And, you know, during the repeal referendum in Ireland, an incredible woman called Andrea Horan, who has a nail bar, Saoirse Ronan goes to the nail bar, like it's like all palm trees and leopard print. And she started this, I think it was just on social media, but it was called the Hun Issues. And it was just so brilliant. And when I was talking to her about it, she said that the reason why she set this up was that, you know, when with the girls that were working in the salon and the girls that were coming into the salon, that they often felt very kind of alienated from people, you know, writing, I suppose, maybe academics or you know, the sort of middle class, you know, college educated women writing their columns in national newspapers, and they felt like that wasn't connected to them or related to them. But they were still wanted to know about these issues and still wanted to talk about politics and still wanted to feel engaged and feel like they weren't being talked down to. So the Hun issues. And I just thought it was such a brilliant idea. And I think that we all want to feel included. Like, you know, and sometimes in these spaces, whether that's politics or whether it's beauty or whether it's fashion, if you have felt excluded for one reason or another, like, it is really nice to feel as if you're kind of being welcomed into that. And I think that is what influencers do. The good ones.
Yeah. And I think this is like such an interesting thing. It's quite obvious from this conversation that you and I have like a bunch of conflicting feelings about influencers, between like being really stirred and moved by the idea that like unconventional people can shake up very conventional value systems that have been the same for like over 100 years of like magazines and studios and basically very small key players that are very elitist and very classist, controlling all media spaces, and that's being disruptive. And that's fucking exciting. And if you don't think it's exciting, you're a moron. Do you know what I mean? While simultaneously being like, we have all these things that we've just talked about, and we have barely scratched the surface on things that are problematic. Instances.
And can I just say one thing as well, is even when you were talking about that, I just was going to say, but I suppose probably the most successful influencers
are rich white people.
Or like very tall and very thin. You know, the way, like, you know, that there are people, I suppose, that are disrupting, but like, you know.
Yes, of course. But also, to counterpoint that, like, most of these people, like, say somebody who has 60,000 followers and, you know, they have a non-conventional beauty standard or voice or body or whatever, for whatever reason, that can, if they are smart, they can probably make a whole living off of that. It doesn't cost that much to run. It's not a company. It's not them and five people. It doesn't cost that much to run one person's life.
Yeah.
You know?
And what is it about, you know, what is it like, this, not discomfort, but often, maybe it is a discomfort with women making money. Like, sometimes it's like, you know, yes, queen. Like, you know, what we see with the Kardashians.
Yeah.
But then sometimes, and like, you know, when I was talking about James Kavanagh earlier, who's an Irish influencer, like, he would very openly say that he gets like a tiny sort of proportion of the abuse or the, I suppose, the trolling, let's say, that his female counterparts would be. And there's a part of me that thinks, what is that about? Like, why is it that like a woman that we feel like is making money from this, or who's getting free, you know, handbags or whatever it is.
Yeah.
Like, what is our discomfort with that? Is that like a really, like, is that quite a big question?
It's a huge question, because this is, and it's really easy to say, oh, the patriarchy, and it poisons everything it touches and blah, blah, blah. Obviously, that is the baseline issue of like all things. But this is women mostly doing it to other women. Mm. And there's a jealousy element. There's also a feeling that a woman with any kind of eyeball on her, if it's a lot of them, has to be held to a standard that is just higher than any other standard that we do for men. And is that because, like, literally through social evolution, we are still not used to paying attention to a lot of women at once?
Yeah. And even it's that thing of, you know, where studies have shown that if women talk, like, you know, for 50% of the time in a meeting, that the men there will think that they've spoken for 90% or, you know, whatever. And then if they speak for 25%, they think that it's been equal. And even when you were saying there about that idea of all these eyeballs on you, it's just such a... Because, I mean, it's not the male gaze, obviously, but I suppose women have been brought up with that idea of, like, of people watching us, you know, that there are people looking at us, looking at our bodies, looking at, you know, our faces, and sort of making judgments about that. Like, it is, I don't know, and I think there's a smart point there, and I'm just not getting at it, but I think there's something interesting about this.
We just love a bit of drama.
Yeah.
Like,
Caroline.
Is there anything, like, just more gorgeous than, like, And I can totally see how people get into it. Like, there being a little drama between two influencers online who used to be friends, but now they're not.
Oh my God. Like, the, do you know what's, what I find, what I love about all of this, right, is that there is this entire other world. Like, I have my first cousin, who I'm, Kira, who I absolutely adore, and she's 19. And, like, she's so funny because, you know, she'll be talking about, like, YouTubers and makeup bloggers, and I have no notion. Like, even the idea of celebrity has shifted so much. Like, they're like, who's Brad Pitt? But it's, like, this TikToker or this, you know, YouTuber. And when the Tati Westwood, is it, and James,
oh yeah, still no fucking clue what that was.
Yes,
yeah,
you know,
the, no,
like,
idea.
That drama, and I for some reason got, like, really sucked into it, and it was just so wonderful because I felt, like, really cool. I was like, oh my God, Kira, what do you think of, and she just, like, her whole face lit up and she was like, oh my God, have you heard about this? I was like, yes, in my day we didn't have, you know. But it, I do think, again, that, like, the way in which these influencers have completely like, destabilized the idea of celebrity is also so, so fascinating.
Yeah, and cool.
Yeah, more of it.
But there's also, I do think that, like, I remember a world where people used to go through Cher's trash, and that would be, like, the cover of every tabloid magazine.
By the way,
kind of thing.
So that sounds like you were around in, like, the 70s.
I know. But, like, I think I remember very clear, like, there was this moment in the early 90s, and for some reason I've just always been gravitated towards Cher. Like, one day I'll do an episode on her, but I think I have too many emotions. But she went out with a way younger guy in the 90s. I think he was in his 20s. She was in her 50s or 40s. And he worked at a bagel shop. And he was called, like, the Bagel Boy. And people went to her trash, and people wouldn't, like, leave her alone and stuff. And like, I think, first of all, the big celebrities pay for better security now, but also I think influencers almost act as a meat shield for real celebrity.
Yes.
In that, like,
we need them.
We, you know, influencers will give you the drama and they'll sell it to you and serve it to you and give it to you on a plate. So that means Meryl Streep is safe.
Exactly. And you know what? It's funny because we had also been talking about doing, you know, discussing royal, kind of royal gossip. Mm-hmm. And in a way, I think, like, the lower tier royalty, like, you know, they're kind of do that for, you know, that the Princess Anne, and I suppose what they wanted Harry and Meghan for as well was to act as a shield, that they could kind of throw the less important royals under the bus,
yes,
in order to protect the Williams, the Kates, the, yes, you know, the Charles and stuff. So you're right there. I suppose there's a, it's an ecosystem. And you know, that you need all kind of tiers, and that influencers have, I suppose, just created another buffer between us and between the real, you know, quote unquote, the real celebrities. So again, I think if you were talking to a Gen Zer, they would be like, well, I'm much more interested in Charlie D'Amelio than Meryl Streep,
and
you know?
You can see that, the sort of trickle down of that, where there's, like, what's so interesting is this is the first generation where being a movie star is a middle-aged profession.
Yes. And then, you know, if you were asking them, you know, like, what do you want to be when you grow up, that I think less would say, I want to be an actress or I want to be a model, but more would be like, I want to be an influencer.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's this thing that goes viral every now and then where it's like a sort of a baby's first vlogging thing.
Yeah.
It's sort of like a plastic phone and a plastic tripod kind of thing. I also think that's fine.
Yeah.
Like, it's basically the panic about influencers, in sum, to wrap up, is that it's this new thing that has emerged within the last 10 to 15 years. And it's frightening for people because it's that thing of, like, oh, anyone can be famous, therefore.
Yeah, the 15 minutes of fame sort of come to life.
Right. And that makes people very nervous. But
do you
ultimately
think it makes them nervous because it makes the concept of fame less special?
It makes fame less special, and it also makes their own work seem more pointless or something. Because lots of people have jobs that they don't like, but they go to every day anyway. And to see somebody make money out of things that seem like leisure, I think it's infuriating.
Yeah. Yeah. And I, you know, I was just thinking there as well, you know, earlier when you were saying about, are we influencers? And I just thought, well, I don't think, well, I'll speak for myself.
Yeah, we aren't.
No, we're not.
But we aren't. But we use things that influencers do to sell our work.
Oh, absolutely. But I suppose at the core of it is, like, I'm like, well, if Instagram, I don't know, like, if Instagram was shut down tomorrow, I have my books. And yeah. I suppose there's this, not like fear, I'm not like, you know, lying awake at night, I can't sleep because yeah. I'm worried for influencers. But I suppose you do think, like, how long can this last? And will they be able to sort of, like, what will the shift be? And will they be able to do that? Because I suppose if you are supporting your family, which a lot of these women are, which is incredible.
Yeah.
Like, you know, buying their homes, putting their kids, you know, through school, you know, paying their bills from the money that they're making from Instagram.
Mm.
It's like, well, is that sustainable? And I don't know. You know, I don't have the answer to that.
Here's the thing. It's interesting when you have a couple of these people on your timeline, and there was a shift, I remember, a while ago, of like a lot of people posting things like, Instagram is hiding my posts.
Yeah.
So if you would like to continue supporting me, please, you know, yeah. add this to collections, set, like favorite it, DM it, da-da-da, all this stuff. And it's quite sad to see. It's very like last dog at the pound energy. But I always want to sort of, you say to those girls, it's like, and it is always girls, it's just your time at doing this is over.
Mm.
Like the thing with the vast majority of these people who get very quick fame is that it goes very quickly. Yeah. And that's kind of maybe how it should be. Maybe you were doing like a very specific trend, very specific thing. You had a very specific take on something and it was popular and you made money for the season that it was available
yeah.
and popular and on the verge of something. And now that time has passed and that's actually fine and there's no shame in that.
So
you know?
You were like a star of the silent movies.
Yeah, kind of.
And now the talkies are here.
The talkies are here.
You either have to adjust or you're just going to have to kind of fade into.
So I think like the vast majority of these people will make money for a couple of years and be like, you know, when they're in their 30s, be like, oh yeah, sure, for a couple of years there. I went to fucking Sri Lanka for nothing. Yeah. That was great. Yeah. That was great crack. And most of them will like take lessons from it, move on with their lives, maybe go into digital consulting or yeah. some kind of thing and be fine. I think a very small percent of them, and I, you know, have a lot of respect for them, they will leave the game with something.
Mm.
And I think that's very interesting. So there yeah. was this comedian, I mean, he's still around, but his Instagram account was The Fat Jewish. Do you remember this guy?
Oh, yes. There was a lot of accusations of
plagiarism and yeah. all of that. He was sort of reposting a lot of comedy content
yes.
on his thing. And like, yes, accusations of plagiarism, but also in his defense, it's like, it was kind of a new format and lots
know,
of people were
I
doing
know,
this.
I know, you'd just be sharing things. And,
yeah, the yeah. rules weren't clear.
Yeah.
Like, he seems like a fairly self-aware person, but ultimately, I was watching an interview with him last night in preparation. He was doing hired to be at a lot of parties and noticed a gap in the market because he was around drinking culture so much that vodka and gin and spirits, they all have brands associated with them, whether it's Grey Goose or Smirnoff. And red wines have things associated with them. And white wines have, like Sauvignon yeah. or whatever, have names associated with them. But nobody had taken that space for rosé yet.
Oh.
And he made a rosé called, like white girl rosé.
Oh my God, I love it.
Yes. And it became the most photographed alcohol of that year. And now he owns a wine company.
And you see, and then you think, like, that's someone who's a branding genius, you know.
Yeah,
like,
right.
I think it's trying to be able to take that skill set and put it into something else. But yeah, I just hope they're investing, you know, that way of like.
Yeah, yeah. I think that is
away.
The 0.1% of people who yeah. use this experience, look around, notice something,
yes.
take this money they're earning, creating a business and yeah. then you're off to the races kind of thing, but yeah. it's a very small proportion. Yeah. I think most
so
of them will be in the first column.
If there's any influencers listening, we're like, guys,
have a long-term
yeah,
plan.
Yeah.
But it's interesting. So we have to wrap up with this. Yeah. So much to say.
I know. I feel like we could be here for another hour.
I know. It's interesting when you see them try and pivot into like books and things.
Mm.
And it's like some of that will work, but most of it will be like, lovely graphics.
I know. And some of it, like this woman, a YouTuber called Melanie Murphy, sent me her book. And I was so nervous before I read it because she's lovely and I kind of wanted to like it, you know.
Yeah.
And from the very first page, I thought, oh no, this woman can write, you know.
Thank
and I
God.
Really enjoyed it. But I thought I had to confront my own snobbery there.
Yeah.
That this assumption, just because she was a YouTuber, just because she's an influencer, that she wouldn't have any other abilities. That the
yeah.
only reason that she would have got a book deal was because she had a big following online. And I read it and I was like, no, she submitted this book with, you know, with 10 followers, it would have
yeah.
been published, you know.
Yeah.
And I think for me, it was that moment of going, you can't make those assumptions about people, which I suppose we all do.
We, like, all,
we
do.
All do with the people we follow.
And that's it.
Yeah.
So very pertinently, you've got a book out called Idol. That's the number one book in Ireland
right now. Oh, thank you. Number 12 in the UK. I was very excited. Hello! So, I know. I'm like, I really just wanted to get into the, you know, the way I'm just like, do I just want to kind of push it up into the top 10?
Well, this is it.
Yeah. Okay, everyone
guys,
listening to this.
Guys, but it is, it's such a brilliant book. You've written so many fucking fantastic books and this is my favourite.
Oh, thank you.
Because it is this great satire of influencer culture while also being, it's very clear that you're not satirizing it from a place of either judgment or ignorance.
Yeah.
Because you can say, oh, anyone who written this book has watched a lot of these fucking, I looked at all these accounts.
Hello, my loves. Hi, guys.
It's so fantastic. If people liked Holly Bourne's How Do You Like Me Now, I would say this is like an intense kind of darker Gone Girly version of that kind of thing. Not version of it, that's diminishing, but you know what I mean? Like,
it's very publishing to do like a comp.
Yeah, you know,
that way. Yeah, like what's a comp?
It's such a propulsive plot while simultaneously just saying very interesting things about this culture that we've just been talking about, you know?
Thank you so much.
I loved it.
Oh, thank you.
I hope it continues to do so well for you.
Yeah, well, yeah, Samantha Miller, who's the main character of Idol, is this American wellness influencer. So it was very fun, I think, to kind of explore that world. So if you're into wellness or influencer culture or sex, power, celebrity, consent, all of those things, this is the beach read for you. Gotta get it into the top 10. Come on, guys.
Come on, guys. Let's pull it together. Come on, followers. All right, Louise, it's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Oh, Caroline, just a joy. You are such a joy.
You're a joy.
No, you are.
This has been Sentimental Garbage, and I've been Caroline O'Donoghue. The podcast was produced and edited by me, with mix and music by Harry Harris and artwork by Gavin Day. If you'd like to email me about the pod, you can do so on sentimentalpod@gmail.com or get in touch with me directly on Twitter or Instagram @Zaraline.